From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, it was announced that Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, died at the age of 58. We'll discuss the controversial leader's military and political career in the hour ahead. And we'll look at what lies ahead for Venezuela, the fourth largest oil supplier to the United States, and under Chavez, a U.S. adversary. We'll also consider the likely successor to Hugo Chavez and whether or not his socialist and revolutionary agendas will continue. Join us for Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Following a two-year battle with cancer, Venezuela President Hugo Chavez died yesterday at the age of 58. A former army paratrooper who headed an attempted coup that led to his being imprisoned, Chavez was a self-proclaimed socialist and populist champion of the poor and took power in 1999 and dominated his native country for 14 years. He won another six-year election to lead Venezuela this past October, and in this morning's opening forum hour, we discussed the life, the politics, and the legacy of Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. And joining us first is Francisco Toro. He's with us from Montreal this morning. He's author of Blogging the Revolution, Caracas Chronicles, and the Hugo Chavez Chronicles. And welcome to the program, Francisco Toro. Good to have you.
Thank you.
A lot of speculation earlier on NPR, and it's certainly going around in the wake of Chavez's death, about not only what's going to happen with the United States, because he was certainly a strong leader of opposition to U.S. interests in Latin America, but also with respect to Cuba. And I suppose a lot depends on whether or not Nicolas Maduro in 30 days wins the election, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, it's really an unprecedented kind of situation. I can't think of another campaign like this. It's going to last 30 days. The first third of it is going to be dominated by what's sure to be an extraordinary kind of public funeral. And people in Venezuela are extremely emotional about President Chavez's figure. There are no neutrals, really.
He was that polarizing, I mean, in the sense that people just literally either loved him or hated him.
He set out to polarize people quite consciously. I mean, this is part of a political strategy that he used right from the beginning in order to consolidate power. And it worked very well for him. You know, he set out to isolate his opponents by painting them as extremists and, you know, right-wing oligarchs aligned under the U.S., which to some extent, you know, in the first years this rule was true. And in order to do that, he had to goad us into positions that were not sustainable. And it's a trap that those of us who have been critical of President Chavez took a few years to wise up to.
Well, he also had this very close alliance with Fidel Castro and actually helped keep the Cuban economy afloat to a great degree, as the Soviets had done before him. In that sense, he was also, positioning himself against the United States, wasn't he?
Well, it's all part of the same strategy. I wrote about it in the New Republic today. The alliance between Chavez and Castro was quite extraordinary. It was really something else that's unparalleled. Chavez was very independent-minded. He had a very big ego. He wouldn't kowtow to anyone, but there are always special rules for Fidel. Fidel has a very particular kind of mythical hero status in the Latin American left as the guy who founded it all. And Chavez, the alliance between Chavez and Fidel was not a normal kind of alliance like the one the U.S. might have with Germany. You know, we had Cuban flags flying above Venezuelan military bases. We had Chavez declaring openly that Cuba's and Venezuela's were the same revolution, that these were two countries with one revolution, and that Venezuela actually had two presidents. In 2006, he argued this strongly, that Fidel Castro was as much of a leader in Venezuela as he was in Cuba. So, and there were tens of thousands of Cubans sent to Venezuela to work as trainers, as doctors, as spies, if we're honest about it. And at billions upon billions of oil dollars going back in the opposite direction. So it's an extraordinarily close alliance.
It was also a Bolivarian revolution that clearly he and Castro were trying to, well, set a fire, if you will, throughout that part of the world. I mean, he helped essentially bolster leftist governments in Ecuador and Bolivia, back to revolutionaries, the FARC group in Colombia, and even Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. What's striking about this at this point is this whole Chavismo, as it was called, seems to be in a kind of suspended animation because this election will take place. And although it seems likely that Nicolas Maduro, who is the likely successor, will probably win the election, you do have some real opposition, don't you, from Enrique Capriles?
That's right. I mean, the country has been very divided for a very long time. And it's always seemed to be when we go to election that Chavismo is between 52 and 58% of the vote. And the opposition in over many elections over the last 14 years only managed to win once by a squeaker in 2007. I think the reason Chavez kept winning had a lot to do, well, with two factors, with basically his personal charisma and with the huge oil revenues that Venezuela was in receipt of that allowed him to spend very freely. You have to remember, Venezuela is a country where there are no real institutional boundaries between the office of the presidency, the ruling party, and state coffers. So, for instance, in the months leading up to election, the most talented managers in the state oil company in PDVSA would be pulled off the jobs, would stop working on oil, and be seconded to the campaign on the public purse. There are big structural advantages in a system like that to be in the party in power. This would tend to make you think that Nicolas Maduro is in a very strong position going into this election, but those mechanics of the state apparatus being behind Maduro, they don't extend to Maduro's charisma, Maduro himself and his charisma. He doesn't really have the kind of magnetic appeal that Chavez had, and he doesn't have the oratorical skills, the charm, and just that connection that Chavez had with his supporters. So
he doesn't sing and dance.
He could go either way.
I guess, really. I mean, Chavez was singing and dancing and going into hours of oratory with a great deal of passion. And like you said, there isn't the charisma there. And there's also all of this oil money, but the structure of Venezuela itself has fallen on hard times. I mean, it's baffling to many people how, mismanaged, I suppose, in terms of putting the money. Chavez has done a great deal for poor people. There's no denying that. But the country's in trouble.
Well, yeah. I mean, people are always really impressed because you see that Chavez multiplied social spending and spending on things like health and education, sometimes by three times as much as was being spent before. And those are very, very big hikes and very impressive. But at the same time, you have to remember that when Chavez took power in 1999, the price of oil was $9 a barrel. And now it's hovering between 90 and 120 over the last few years. So if you triple the social spending at the same time that your own receipts were multiplied by 10 or by 12, there's a big gap there that has to be explained. And so where did all this money go? In the 14 years that he was in power, it's estimated that Venezuela had $1 trillion in oil revenue. Now, realize that in the U.S. context, $1 trillion, well, people in Congress throw those kinds of sums around like they're popcorn, but for a poor third world country like Venezuela, it's simply astronomical figure. It's more than 3 years GDP, maybe 4 years GDP, that just rained into state coffers simply by putting holes in the ground and pumping out the loop and putting it on tankers and shipping it up north. So when there's that much oil money around, you can afford to waste and squander and mismanage and steal and give away a lot of it and still also multiply your spending on social programs. And that's what happened in Venezuela.
Francisco Toro with us from Montreal, author of Blogging the Revolution, Caracas Chronicles, and the Hugo Chavez Chronicles. We want to go to Caracas now and welcome Rory Carroll onto the program. He's South America correspondent for The Guardian. And Rory Carroll, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I want to get a reading from you initially on, I know there's preparations for a massive funeral and there's tremendous mourning and there's probably jubilation as well. What are you seeing in Caracas?
It's a very strange contrast here. In the east of the city, which is traditionally the heartland of the opposition, and the streets are largely deserted. They're very quiet. It's kind of a hushed atmosphere around. People are not, you know, people are celebrating. They're keeping it to themselves. Meantime, downtown, where I've just come from, and there are tens of thousands of Chavistas who have poured down from the hillside slums, which have always been the bastion of Hugo Chavez, and they're accompanying the caravan, which is taking his body from the military hospital where he died to the military base of Huerta Tuna, which will be his temporary resting place. So the scenes down there are electric. There are thousands of people on motorbikes. There's National Guardsmen. There's police. There are soldiers, there are people weeping, but also there's a semi kind of carnival atmosphere there as well. I mean, people feel that they want to almost celebrate who he was, and I think possibly because some people are still in denial that he's gone. So it's very strange. It's a tale of two cities today in Caracas.
They'd be in denial because he said he was cured. I mean, he clearly probably came back to Venezuela to die, but he had said publicly, you know, the movement can't go on without me, and I'm cured and I'm fine.
I know, and one of the most extraordinary things here is no one mentions that now. And the fact that basically he lied to his own people last year in claiming that he had this miracle cure. He claimed three times to have been cured. And in fact, it turns out that as many people had suspected, this was untrue. And yet there was absolutely no recriminations at all. That I spoke to dozens of people this morning, and they're all just either praising the guy, and they don't feel that they were misled. And if anything, this is the new myth that has been born, or that has been stated by Chavez's designated heir, Nicolas Maduro, yesterday, that the cancer was in fact created by enemies, and that he was in fact poisoned with cancer. And several people today repeated that to me, that they really do seem to believe that perhaps the cancer was a form of murder.
Yeah, well, also, I remember Chavez claiming the United States didn't put a man on the moon. I mean, some of these ideas seem to be directed largely against the United States, these rather strange fabrications. And there is still, I presume, even with Maduro, an ongoing sense of the United States as the antagonist. But we just get a reading on you on the election, because Capriles, who ran against him in October and who was a state governor, actually does have support, doesn't it?
Yeah, yes, he does. And as I pointed out in my book, Comandante, which I have to plug, has been published tomorrow. Capriles ran a very good campaign last October. He mobilized the opposition, and he won more than 6 million votes. And that was a terrific showing by the opposition. And yet he still got crushed because Chavez went one better and got a million more votes than Capriles. So now there's a degree of uncertainty here. People don't know what's going to happen next. I mean, people think that Nicolas Maduro will be the favorite, that he has all of the emotional impact of Chavez's death to mobilize the Chavista bases. And there are still the after effects of a confected economic boom, which Chavez had created for his own re-election last October. And there's still enough of this kind of artificial money in the system to give people a sense of well-being. So I think that would be enough to push Maduro over the edge and to give him to keep him in power.
Well, let's assume Maduro does win. I mean, we said earlier he doesn't seem to have anything resembling the charisma or the sort of passionate charm, whatever you want to call it, that Hugo Chavez had. Will the Bolivar Revolution continue, and will these strange alliances that, and I say strange with an emphasis on that, that Hugo Chavez forged with people like Mugabe and Assad and, for that matter, Ahmadinejad continue?
I think that, I mean, most of those supposed alliances that Chavez kept proclaiming were always more posturing than anything. He used it to cement his revolutionary credentials and just to tweak the United States and annoy Westerners and to stay in the headlines. And in that sense, it was politically astute, I suppose. What matters more for the future of Venezuela is to what extent Nicolas Maduro will be able to keep together the different factions of Chavismo. We have, for example, the military factions, which are largely opportunistic and in some cases kleptocratic they just want to be able to keep making money. Then you have left-wing ideologues, civilians, who often are either Marxists or quasi-Marxists, and they want a greater ideological purity and radicalization. And then you have other people who are more in the middle, who just have government benefits or government jobs, and they just want to protect those. So Maduro's task will be keeping these different factions together. And it'll be difficult because he lacks Chavez's charisma. I've been with Maduro in meetings, and he makes no presence. Even the fact that he's a big bearish guy, he doesn't make his presence felt. And also, he won't have the same money that Chavez had, because Venezuela, despite this amazing oil boom that it has had, is slowly going broke, and they're having to borrow billions from the Chinese just to plug the gaps in the revolution.
Rory Carroll, appreciate very much your being with us. Congratulations on your book tomorrow. What's the title again?
Comandante, Inside Hugo Chavez's Venezuela.
Glad to have you with us. Again, Rory Carroll is South American correspondent for The Guardian. We want to go now to Pomona College and talk with Miguel Tinker Salas, who is professor of history and Latin American studies. His specialty is Venezuela. And Professor Salas, good to have you with us. Welcome. Okay, we're trying to connect with him. Actually, Francisco Toro, let me go back to you, because I was going to ask about the Hugo Chavez legacy, and I happen to be reading Rory Carroll, and he talked about the legacy as being an ambiguous one. We've been talking about how polarized Hugo Chavez was, but he was talking about it in an ambiguous in the sense of both triumph, ruin, and uncertainty, and said there was Chavez the dictator and Chavez the hero and the Democrat and the autocrat and the progressive and the bully. I mean, it's all there, really, that duality, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, because at the center of Chavez's rule was this strange kind of contradiction, which is that he was elected, he was popular, people loved him. You know, we talk about charisma in these kinds of very clinical terms, but sometimes I feel that it's worth taking a moment to unpack that term. This wasn't just the charisma of a Bill Clinton or a normal politician in the normal democratic setting making a speech and making people excited. People genuinely seem to feel this personal, mystical bond with the leader. And Chavez's rallies often had this kind of revival meeting feel to them that wasn't in the end political at all.
Well, forgive me, you're saying in effect, as I guess others have probably characterized him, as a kind of messianic figure, really, wasn't he?
That's right.
To the poor, especially. Yeah.
And he said it again and again, and, you know, the slogans, you know, Chavez is the people, Chavez is Venezuela. These slogans speak of this kind of mystical union, and they speak very strongly of it.
Well, I wanted to bring Miguel Tinker Salas. I think we have him now. Yes, Professor Salas, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
And again, he's professor of history and Latin American studies, specializing in Venezuela at Pomona College. Talking about Chavez's legacy and just how dualistic it is and how bifurcated it is. I mean, the poor really revered him, but certainly the privileged and the patrician class, if there is such a thing in Venezuela, and there is indeed, for the most part, well, certainly we're suspicious of him or loathe him. How do you see his legacy? I mean, particularly in terms of violations of human rights and the bullying side of things.
I think his legacy is assured by what he did to transform Venezuela. Whether you agree with his politics or not, the reality is that Venezuela of 2013 is not the Venezuela of 1998, and neither is Latin America. So I think that to the extent that he centered issues of inequality, of poverty, of a new sense of Latin American identity, and of a positioning in Venezuela within the context of Latin America. And in fact, President Lula said in one of his comments regarding Chavez was that Latin America owed Chavez the reintegration of Venezuela within Latin America. So to that extent, I think that his legacy is assured within Venezuela and within the social movements and the political culture of Latin America as well, and particularly in the promotion of South-South relationships. Irrespective of whether, you know, he had a top-down management, he was authoritarian, he was autocratic, irrespective of all those issues. And the economics of this, of the reality in Venezuela, is much different. When Chavez came to power, oil was at $7 a barrel, and it was Chavez's effort to try to buttress OPEC and to renew the relationship with OPEC, which Venezuela was the founder of, that in many ways positioned Venezuela to reap the benefits of social policy of the oil increase, and then to sow that money into social policy, spending over 60% of it, a 60% increase in social policy programs.
But as detractors say and point out, that with all that oil money, the country still is in shambles in many respects. He ruined modernization and decentralization. He was a dictator. He packed the oil industry with incompetent cronies. I mean, I'm sure you've heard all of these things, and certainly right. clamped down on free expression. So also rewrote the Constitution in his favor. I mean, all of these things are outweighed by the kind of love and what he did in terms of the revolution, spreading the revolution.
But each one of those things could actually have a different narrative as well. I mean, if you looked at the narrative of the oil industry, renationalizing the oil industry, reclaiming the oil industry, brought tremendous profits to Venezuela, being able to renegotiate the contracts that had in many ways given away Venezuelan profits at 16.2-thirds royalty for the heavy crude in the Orinoco Basin, allowed the government to reclaim new areas in terms of the media. Proponents of Chavez would point out the fact that most of the media is in private hands, most of it is opposed to the government. In terms of other issues, yes, the Constitution was rewritten by a committee, not of Chavez, but of delegates who were elected by the population. Sure, he had an overpowering role within it, but also he inserted into that Constitution the right to be recalled, something that doesn't exist in the Constitution of many countries in the Americas, and in fact face the recall and actually survive the recall effort. And the kind of political and social and cultural empowerment that has taken place in Venezuela has in fact transformed the political landscape in ways that we will still continue to see many decades into the future. And I think that's what he will be remembered for. And now he will have symbolic power. I mean, I think beyond his physical presence, which is now no longer here, but the reality is that he will become a symbol of those poor, the symbol of those who had been left out, and of those efforts at resolving inequality.
Well, what are your thoughts about Hugo Chavez in the wake of his death? He died at the age of 58 after a battle with cancer, You're invited to join us. Let us know what you think, or join the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number is available to you, and you can call us now at 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, we welcome your phone calls. Again, 866-733-6786, or simply email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. If you prefer, you can communicate with us by Facebook, by going on our Facebook page, or by tweeting us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum. And a complicated legacy, certainly, that is being left by Hugo Chavez. We're discussing the controversial leader's career, what lies ahead for Venezuela, which is, by the way, the fourth largest oil supplier of the United States, and under Chavez, certainly an adversary of the United States. It's also a country with the biggest natural gas reserves in Latin America and the largest deposit of oil in the world. So there's a lot at stake in terms of who's going to be succeeding Hugo Chavez and what's going to be the tenor of that nation as we move into the post-Chavez era. There's still, before we go to a break here and then bring in our callers, Professor Salas, there's still soaring prices and shortage of basic goods. I mean, the economy's out of whack there, isn't it?
Well, I think the major contradiction continues to be a rentier economy. Venezuela continues to depend on oil, and this has been an issue since Venezuela discovered oil. Venezuela became a net importer of food in 1935, as I highlight in my own book. The reality is that the oil creates distortions in the economy. 90% of the economy it depends upon oil exports and oil production. You bring those dollars back into the economy. You disperse those throughout the economy. You have more dollars searching for smaller and smaller amount of goods, and that causes inflation. So, yes, the fundamental problem of the Venezuelan economy is and continues to be how oil distorts and creates distortions within the economy. And that's something that Venezuela has been grappling with, as I suggested, since the discovery of oil, and continues to be an unresolved issue. There's been many major efforts at increasing agricultural production and of increasing local production, but yet those have still not been able to fulfill the needs. And also keep in mind, Venezuela's population continues to grow.
Well, we will continue. We're coming up on a break. When we come back, more and your calls. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Hugo Chavez died yesterday at the age of 58 after a long battle with cancer, and we're discussing his career, and we're looking ahead at what lies ahead for Venezuela. We're also considering the likely successor to Chavez and discussing whether or not his socialist and revolutionary agendas will continue after his death. And certainly he has had an extraordinary impact, to put it mildly, on not only Venezuela but Latin America. Amazing impact. And there will be an election in 30 days to find out who his successor is. A controversial figure beyond any shadow of a doubt, an autocrat, and also someone who is spoke very and acted on behalf of democratic principles in many respects. I was interested to note the president of Argentina saying, yeah, okay, you know, he may have been a dictator, but there were 13 elections. What kind of dictator has 13 elections, or for that matter, a referendum? Rory Carroll was with us earlier, South American correspondent for The Guardian, and we have with us for the rest of the hour Francisco Toro, who is author of Blogging the Revolution, Caracas Chronicles, and the Hugo Chavez Chronicles. He's with us from Montreal. And with us from Pomona College is Miguel Tinker Salas, who's professor of history and Latin American studies, specializes in Venezuela. And I'm sorry, Professor Salas, we had to go to a break there. You were finishing a thought, and then I want to go to our callers.
No, as I suggested, much of what has transpired in terms of oil policy has also been the fact that the government took a very proactive role in recapturing what they assumed was a loss of markets and promoting its role within OPEC. So I think that that's a fundamental feature as well that allowed it to spend the money on the social programs.
Well, let's bring our callers in. Let's find out your thoughts in the wake of the death of Hugo Chavez. And we go first to John. Good morning.
Good morning. How's it going, Mr. Toro, Professor Lucrez? Just wanted to ask a quick question. What does your guest think about possible involvement of the U.S. government in the run-up to elections, overtly and covertly, certainly looking back to the constitutional coup in Honduras and the revolution in Mali, both executed by U.S.-trained forces. I'm actually an ex-JSOC guy from psychological operations. I just don't want to come off as a conspiracy theorist. There's certainly ample evidence, you know, for such a maneuver. I'm just wondering what your guests think about what methods we might take with regional actors and on our own.
Well, let me go first to you on this, Francisco Toro. Certainly, Chavez complained bitterly about the United States taking a role in elections in the past and trying to overthrow him and all of that sort of thing. How much of that has validity, I don't know. But what about the caller's question? Is there validity to the idea that the United States may try to have a hand in this? They've certainly got a lot of dogs in this hunt.
Well, there is quite a bit of evidence about this because Julian Assange did us all a favor and leaked the relevant documents from the State Department a few years back. And if you go through the leaks from the Venezuelan embassy on WikiLeaks, you see that, in fact, there's a bit of a beeline of Venezuelan opposition leaders going to the U.S. embassy in Valladolid and Caracas and asking for money and of diplomats in the U.S. embassy telling them to shove up. Now, those are secret leaked memos. I think it's true. I think that, you know, there is this mythology in the international left as the spooky, all-powerful CIA that is behind everything that happens in Latin America. And it's badly over-egged as far as I'm concerned.
And what do you think about this, Professor Salas?
Miguel, I don't think that the Venezuelan opposition needs any stimulus from the U.S. to oppose Chavez. I think that they have their own vested interest in opposing Chavez. I don't doubt that Venezuela in the upcoming election will be under a microscope, that they will be support for NGOs and other organizations. But I think that the U.S. will be well served to keep its distance from Venezuela unless it wants to be drawn into an election in which it becomes the opposition, in which the Venezuelan government and the PSUV and the Maduro and the Chavista forces will say in a vote for the opposition will be a vote for the U.S., which is what we saw in Peron in Argentina, what we saw in other countries as well.
Well, you're probably going to hear it from Maduro, aren't you?
But I'm sure we will. But if there's a smoking gun, that changes the context. But I think that, as I said earlier, the opposition does not need stimulus from the U.S. to want to oppose Chavez. They have their own vested interest for doing that.
And I thank the caller. Let me go right to another caller. Alejandro, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Michael. I was calling with a comment on what Mr. Torres said that about the economy in Venezuela. Well, President Chavez did enfranchise a lot of the unrepresented people in Venezuela. I do take issue that none of the economic progresses that that he made justified the fact that he created a state that is super violent. It's the city is completely rid with murders and all kinds of acts of violence. And it has created a climate where professionals or young professionals such as myself have to leave the country in search of better opportunities because we're essentially not welcome in our own country because we oppose the government. I feel that in the years to come, Venezuela will see a void of professionals because everybody that has been educated has essentially left the country. And I feel that that will that is also a very bad legacy for the president, because the country will feel that that lack of educated people for years and years to come.
Well, Francisco Toro, can you comment on the brain drain? That's what the caller is talking about.
Well, it should be very clear that this isn't an accidental thing, or this isn't a decision that's been made on a whim by people. There is large evidence of, pardon me for this, there is large evidence of the Chavez administration using blacklists with millions of Venezuelans who signed to request the recall referendum that Professor Tinker Salas talked about earlier, and cross-referencing those lists with people asking for a whole range of state services or jobs and denying them to them. So there's been large-scale and sort of systematic prosecution of political dissidents of Venezuela in the Chavez era, and that tends to be overlooked or minimized in much of the reporting about the brain drain.
Professor Salas, and by the way, Miguel Tinker Salas is the author of, I want to get your book in here, The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Citizenship in Venezuela. I'm sure you may want to respond, but I want to add an email here that I'm looking at from a listener named Rick, and who says, can any of your guests address where all the oil money has gone?
Well, first of all, let me suggest that the idea that there was a creation of a state terror is simply false. The reality is that there is crime in Venezuela. The reality is that the state did not understand that by reducing poverty, it would not alleviate crime. The crime continues to be a major issue in Venezuela, and there is no doubt about that. But that's also a national issue for all Venezuelans to grapple with. And the state has to provide enough resources for trained police and other agents to be able to deal with crime and not simply expect that by reducing poverty, they're going to reduce crime. That's a serious issue and keeps on going. But Mr. Toro, in a previous interview with myself, indicated this is not a terror state. This is a state that has not relied on the use of terror in Venezuela. There is no one knocking on your door in midnight or in the mornings. The reality is that this is a state that has a large popular base. Yes, there is polarization, the way there is in the U.S. or the way there is in other countries. And the reality is that there hasn't been a huge brain drain. Not every intelligent person educated has left Venezuela. There are hundreds of thousands of professionals in Venezuela and professional associations and university-trained professionals in Venezuela, and they all have not left the country. So I think that there's a bit of an exaggeration there, and I think that a closer look at the reality in Venezuela would give a different perspective.
But what about Mr. Toro's point that the Venezuelan government under Chavez had blacklists and was essentially...
That refers to the Tascon list. That was a list that was developed by a congressman that was actually repudiated by Chavez. Unfortunately, it was used, and the president himself said that it was wrong to use. But undoubtedly, some people were blacklisted from that. They did not receive contracts. I think that was a tremendous mistake. And I don't think it would happen again.
I'm reading a listener comment from our website. The death of Chavez is a great loss. He was not perfect, but he stood up to the leaders of the U.S. empire, to the thugs of Wall Street and the Pentagon and the CIA, who would like nothing better than to grind the common people of Venezuela into a pulp, figuratively or even literally, if it could bring profit. You know, Professor Salas, many of us remember, of course, Hugo Chavez standing up in the United Nations and denouncing then-President George W. Bush and talking about the smell of sulfur and likening Bush to Satan. There's been a more cordial, seemingly a more amicable kind of relationship with President Obama. And can I get you to sort of assess what that all means? I mean, is it indeed better relationship now with the United States because Obama's president?
I'm not quite sure I'd say the better relationships. In fact, I think the consensus is that the Obama administration has done very little differently than the Bush administration in terms of not only Venezuela, but in terms of Latin America as a whole. As much of which happened with Obama, there was a promise of a change. In fact, candidate Obama in 2008 talked about a new alliance for progress for Latin America, went to the summit in Trinidad and promoted that there would be a new policy. He met with Lula, Brazil. Chavez gave him a book from Galeano, Open Veins in Latin America. But the reality was that nothing changed in the result. There was a coup in Honduras. There was a continued push for free trade with Colombia, with Panama, with Peru and other countries. So the policy has remained largely the same. I think that there is an opportunity now, some of the statements that Obama made yesterday, and also with the transition. But nothing's going to happen in the next 30 days. In the next 30 days, you're going to be a hotly contested election in which there'll be a lot of rhetoric, nationalist sentiments on both sides, and I don't think that that will have a context for any change in the short run.
Let me bring on more of your calls, and let me go next to Thomas. Thomas, join us on Forum. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I'm actually from Cuba, and one of the things that I've seen, and this is actually I still have family in Cuba, is that the whole idea with Hugo Chavez, how great he has been to Venezuela, has been nothing more than a copy of what Cuba is right now, which is a country that people love because it's actually stuck in a time warp. And then when they're talking about the whole thing with election being democratic, you seem to be doing the same thing that we do, that they used to do in Cuba, and they still do. They're doing during the election, if you don't vote because you don't agree with the person who they're supposed to be in the ballot, you actually picked up in a bus and said to vote. Otherwise, you can lose your job or you can be demoted exponentially. So how democratic that system has been with Chavez, and people keep saying he's a hero. I mean, there's a difference between fighting for the people and making some type of dictatorship.
Well, the legacy seems to be both, Francisco Toro. I mean, he did fight for the poor. He inspired the poor and helped the poor. But at the same time, as we've been saying, he violated human rights in the same way that Fidel Castro and the Cuban regime has violated human rights. And he stifled free expression. I think the record is pretty clear, isn't it?
Well, actually, I don't necessarily agree with that. One thing I do agree with Professor Tienkesalas about is that accusations of Chavez on matters of dictatorship or the label dictatorship is wildly inappropriate. I mean, it isn't a terror state. It's not Cuba. It's not North Korea. There are no gulags. These things are true, and they're important to say. My problem with the regime comes on a different level. It comes at the level of institutions. Now, when we think about a democracy, we don't really mean that you're going to elect a leader and then you're going to hand him a blank check so he can run the country the way Louis XIV ran France in the 17th century. But Chavez's understanding of the democratic system is precisely that. It's that you have one vote, you give him power, and then he administers all the power. He'll talk about participation, but that's participation at the margins, only for people to support him. And when you have one person personally using all the powers of the state, the courts, the military used as a precarious guard, every aspect of the state used as an agency of the presidential palace. None of the democratic give and take, the debates, institutions, the normal way that democratic life is carried out through democratic institutions, none of that can happen. And that's what we saw in Venezuela, with this freezing of the democratic public sphere, with this degradation of the institutional capacity of our National Assembly, of our courts, of our ombudsman, of our anti-corruption authorities, of our military, of our oil industry, to act independently and to act with some institutional authority of their own that wasn't purely derived from an order given by the president live on a TV speech.
No, I don't mean to suggest there's a replication of Cuba. I meant in terms of human rights violations, both countries under their dictators have certainly moved in that direction more seriously. I suppose it would be hardly arguable in Cuba. Professor Salas, you were going to add something here.
The dictator falls into the same assumption when we both have just simply said that there really is not a dictatorship in Venezuela. There has been elections taking place, and the elections have been relatively transparent. I mean, and the reality is that in every case, the opposition, when Chavez has won, has recognized that the president has won. No doubt that an incumbent has a tremendous advantage in any political arena, whether it's the U.S. or Venezuela. But the idea that somehow people vote and if they don't vote are taken away in buses is simply absurd in Venezuela. The reality is that there is tremendous mobilization on both sides, and both sides have access to tremendous levels of media as well. And in many ways, Chavez has been punished by his own supporters when they did not turn out to vote for his constitutional reform in 2007. So again, much of what the record in Venezuela shows and speaks to is contrary to what your caller simply indicated. And also, I would take issue with Mr. Toro, although I agree with him at some level, on the question of institutions and the need to create institutions and difference and autonomy for institutions. The reality is that there has been a new empowerment in Venezuela. It's not a collective therapy session. It is, in fact, new social actors on the stage in Venezuela. The way we've seen and the outcome of the elections underscores that, as same as we've seen that throughout the entire of Latin America in the last decade.
What about the charges against Chavez closing down a TV station, using state resources as part of re-election campaign? That's according to Robert Velasquez of Caracas NGO Citizenship Monitoring. I mean, there have been, in other words, a flurry of these kind of charges that have been consistent during his whole campaign.
The flurry regarding RCTV, I mean, if you simply put it in the context of the United States, here was a TV station that used the public airways to support a coup. I mean, there's just simply no way around it. And that was a very undemocratic action. Would I have shut down RCTV? No, I would not have. But the reality is that the government had legal standing to do that. These are public airways. This is not privately controlled airways. They're public airways in which RCTV took a very clearly political stand that stepped over the line of any major international institution that would have done the same thing, would have faced similar conditions. So, yes, I mean, I think that there has been unduly, again, I mean, underscore that obviously when you're an incumbent, you have access to resources that you don't have, and that creates a relative inequality. But, again, the opposition in Venezuela is not poor. They have access to resources. They have use of media. They have use of international support that comes in the role of the particularly the role that the international media has taken in supporting much of the opposition. So I think that this is not somehow a David against Goliath. This is, at many levels, has a significant amount of equality in the context. It's not an asymmetrical power relationship. And that what's different is the fact that there are new social actors that participate on this stage and who claim a space.
Well, we also heard from Nicolas Maduro and the defense minister in Venezuela of both giving a call for unity and peace. Do you foresee, Francisco Toro, problems with this election and the post-transition? Would there be, for example, a fight over interpretation of the Constitution?
Well, I think it's very early to tell the way that this is going to play out. We don't really know anything about Nicolas Maduro even now, even though he's been on the public eye for really the last 14 years, because he's only been on the public eye as a Chavez yes-man. I mean, this is part of the institutional degradation that I speak about all the time. It's the fact that Chavez insisted on these kind of elaborate displays of loyalty and subservience for everyone around him. And anybody in the upper echelons of government who showed any sign of independent thought or action was immediately purged. And if you keep that system going for 14 years, what you end up is with a system where the only people who rise to the top are the people who never say no, who only say yes. But the problem with the yes man is that you don't really know what he's thinking. You just know what he's saying. So is Nicolás Maduro a pro-Cuban totalitarian extremist? Is he somebody who could, over time, have more of a democratic bent to him? Is he somebody who is going to open those gulags that we haven't had? We simply have no idea, because he only rose to the position that he's in today by never showing his hand.
Let me bring more callers on. And Mary, good morning to you.
Good morning, hi, Michael. I wanted to mention, I don't remember what year that was, and I don't know if he did that every year, but I understand that there was a time that low-income people in Chicago were supplied with heating oil at a very low price from Chavez. And he also, when Katrina happened, he volunteered for Katrina with assistance and was turned down.
I think she's right on both counts. Is she not, Professor Salas?
Yeah, the project she's referring to, the program, was run through CITGO, which is a U.S. Subsidiary of a Venezuelan oil company, PDVSA, and they did supply oil at subsidized rates to existing programs in the Boston area, in the New York area, and other areas, and they did attempt to provide tankers of oil during Katrina. And that fell into the larger issue of how oil was used by Venezuela, building on what had been a previous policy of oil to Central American countries beginning in the 1970s, when it was difficult to obtain given the oil crisis at that time. And it happens through Petrocaribe, which offers oil at long-term credit rates to countries like Cuba, like the Dominican Republic, like Nicaragua, and other countries. And that has thus increased the kind of support that Venezuela has in the region. Venezuela has used oil as part of its foreign policy historically, and under Chavez it reached a different level as well.
Well, they also sent Cuba oil that Cuba bought really at cost and was able to sell and enhance their own economy.
Well, Cuba receives about 100,000 barrels of oil a day, and it's a lifeline for Cuba, particularly after its loss of the Soviet Union in that context. But I think that it's part of the larger, and the criticism from the opposition is obviously those resources could be used to improve conditions in Venezuela. But I think that any government attempts to create foreign policy that benefits and positions itself within the context of Latin America.
Well, it's funny, when Chavez was sending oil here, helping people up in Massachusetts and so forth, on the one hand, he was getting thanks and gratitude, and on the other hand, people were saying this is part of, you know, the tweaking of the American Uncle Sam and all that. I'm looking actually at a listener named Roberto who writes on our Facebook page, part of where the oil wealth went includes providing heating oil to poor communities across the United States and more than 400 Native American tribes. This was in response to a request from a Kennedy son with an energy nonprofit, I think that was Robert Kennedy Jr., while every other oil company refused even to respond. John writes on our website, the death of Chavez is not a great loss. Please ask any Venezuelan expat here in the U.S. He was the sum of all these criticisms, not a hero. His time is long past. Please stop the end justifies the means excuses for what was a brutal dictatorship by him in Venezuela. And another listener posts on our website, President Chavez ruled exactly like the Godfather. He treated Venezuela's natural resources and government cash coffers as his personal property. Management positions, government appointments were made based on loyalty, not ability or competence. He eliminated, imprisoned, murdered all foes, real violence against all dissent. He gave the poor to the poor to gain support from the street while taking the majority of the country's wealth for himself. And there's no rule of law, no free speech, get in line or be killed. Chavez is a criminal boss and nothing more. And I think both of our guests would disagree with that.
I think I've already stated, I think that's a complete exaggeration, and I think it undermines the opposition's point, because, in fact, that has not been the case in Venezuela. I think it's an over-exaggeration, and it really does them a disservice and loses them credibility.
And let me also add, it was Joseph Kennedy II, not Robert Kennedy Jr. I'm sorry. Are we going to add something here, Francisco Toro?
Well, yes, I was going to add that to understand this heating oil program in the U.S., for the scandal that it actually is, you have to think through a little bit what conditions are like, for instance, in a Venezuelan hospital. Venezuela is a country that has a hospital system that predated the Chavez era. It was built by previous democratic administrations, and it was in pretty creaky, bad condition by the time that Chavez took power. When Chavez took power, he decided to make his main contribution to the health system this network of primary health care out clinics in various shanty towns. And because he could take credit for that, but he couldn't take credit for hospitals, hospitals are starved of funds to the point where if you go to a Venezuelan hospital today, you are expected to provide everything. If you need gauze, you have to provide the gauze. If you need medicine, you need to provide the medicine. If the surgeon needs a scalpel, you have to bring it for him. And then you might get treated. Now, these are atrocious conditions that cost Venezuelans lives every day. And what I would like to ask is, you know, didn't some of the money that should have gone to providing decent hospital care, to providing decent jails, to providing decent services for Venezuela's population, didn't some of that end up funding essentially a PR drive in the United States to make the government look good? And
let me just take exception to
that. Outrage?
I mean, I think that's an absurd claim. My father died in a Venezuelan hospital in 1989. I had to bring gauzes. I had to bring all the materials that were used by the hospital where he was attended. And this was long before Chavez. The problems in Venezuelan hospitals are long-lasting. And the idea that somehow, yes, there are problems today, but the idea that these problems did not exist in the past, I think, is absurd and does not reflect reality most people face in Venezuelan hospitals throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And that's the reality of why Chavez came to power. Unfortunately, the problem with the hospitals persists and continues, and I think that it has to be addressed by the government. But to say that they didn't exist in the past, I think, is simply not a reflection of reality.
Well, I want to bring more of our callers on, and we'll go to Carlos. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Well, I was going to refer to what the two professors have been talking about. Well, Venezuela, I think everybody's talking about the fact that there is more money into the social services, but nobody talks about the performance of those social services. Venezuela is now the third country in the world with more violent deaths in the world. If you think about the fact that a country with more than 10,000 deaths, murders a year, Venezuela is number one in the world. So a person in Ashanti town in Venezuela, the life expectancy is probably 25 years old. My father participated in at the beginning and collaborated with the Chavez government in designing a health system that the conclusion of that project was that Venezuela should follow the Uruguayan model, that is a universal health care, and nothing was done about that project. So basically, if the goal of socialism, the famous socialism of the 21st century, is universal health care, a universal education, the failure of the social system in Venezuela is outrageous, considering the fact, you know, that there is not universal health care, there is not universal education, and the fact that there is 22,000 deaths, violent deaths a year. I would add a comment in relation to this false trade-off between freedom and social services, because the impact of those social services, the fact that Venezuela is number one in terms of countries with more than 10,000 deaths a year, is a civil war in Venezuela, basically.
All right, Carlos, we're almost out of time here, and let me go to Francisco Toro.
Well, I agree. I think it's lamentable. After $1 trillion in oil revenues, we are, at least in the hospital system, pretty much where we began. I mean, yes, I'm very explicit about it. The hospitals were terrible before Chavez. This is why people elected Chavez. We wanted something better. People wanted to turn the corner. People wanted to strengthen their democratic institutions, but to be listened to. And instead, we're 14 years into something that calls itself a revolution, but that has left things like the hospitals exactly where they were.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, but it has been a rich and, I think, enlightening discussion. I want to thank our participants, Rory Carroll, whom we spoke with earlier, South American correspondent for The Guardian, who joined us from Caracas, and Miguel Tinker-Salas, who is with us from Pomona College, professor of history and Latin American studies with a specialty in Venezuela, also the author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Citizenship in Venezuela, and Francisco Toro, author of Blogging the Revolution, Caracas Chronicles, and the Hugo Chavez Chronicles. Thank you all, and thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Next hour, we're going to take up the Kenya elections, and we're also going to talk about those lights you see on the Bay Bridge. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.